And I'm going to do to sketch what happens to the Lagrangian with higher extended supersymmetry, and also tell you a few things that change when you make the supersymmetry transformations local. But these won't be in any detail, but I'll just give you some kind of idea, hopefully. And then we'll go on to the next big topic, which is supersymmetry breaking. So let's think about n equals 2 and n equals 4 global SUSY. So let's just remember in n equals 1 SUSY, let's summarize basically the action S is a function of the Kähler potential. So it depends on the Kähler potential, the superpotential, in general the gauge kinetic function, and our phi A Eliopoulos terms. So any parameters that we have in these functions will also have as parameters of the theory. And as we pointed out before, it's a special case of an n equals naught or no supersymmetry theory with a particular spectrum, number of bosons equals number of fermions, relations between the couplings, and so on. So in the n equals 2 case, it's just a generalization of this. So this is a special case of n equals 1 theory. I'll remind you about the vector multiplet in n equals 2, vector multiplet. We have a gauge field, its spin a half partner. So these are part of the vector supermultiplet of n equals 1. And then they're married with a chiral superfield of n equals 1. So I'm going to call this chiral piece big phi. And I'm going to call the vector supermultiplet V. So actually, when we have an n equals 2 theory with just one superfield in it, for one superfield, one vector superfield, the superpotential is 0 in n equals 2. And in fact, you can write down the whole theory in terms of just one function now. So the Kähler potential and the gauge kinetic function can be written in terms of a prepotential curly F. So it's some function of the chiral superfield part, and it's holomorphic. So actually what happens is the gauge kinetic function is, you can take the derivative twice with respect to the chiral superfield in order to get the gauge kinetic function, and the Kähler potential is phi dagger e to the 2v times df by d phi plus summation conjugate. Okay, if it's u1 I guess we have a Q in there as well. Yep.
Is there significance to the derivative operator written as a variational derivative? Or just, is it just?
Well, it's just because, you know, phi is a field, right? It depends on space-time coordinates. But I mean, no, don't worry about it.
So what I'm saying is f a function of phi or a function of null? Because the notation seems to see, you know.
Oh, it's a function of phi. Yeah. So at tree level, in a renormalizable theory, the prepotential is phi squared, and the one loop correction to the prepotential goes like something like 1 over 16 pi squared times phi squared log phi squared over lambda squared, where lambda is some high energy cutoff. So it's a cutoff of the Wilsonian action. And then there's no high loops in perturbation theory. So it's a quite simple theory. However, there are some additional non-perturbative corrections. For example, from instantons, and you can see see Seiberg and Witten in 94 for details on that. Okay, so now we can ask, well, okay, what happens with the n equals 4 theory? And, of course, this is a special case now of n equals 2, or n equals 1, or n equals 0. Remind you of the vector multiplet in n equals 4. So that's equal to a mu lambda sine 1 phi 1. So it's equal to n equals 2 vector supermultiplet plus an n equals 2 hyper supermultiplet. Which contains a chiral and an antichiral. Oops. Sorry. N equals 1 supermultiplet. So, all right, now there are no free functions at all. There's not even a prepotential. Only one free complex parameter. Which parameterizes the gauge kinetic function, coupling in this case. It's usually written in this form. So of course, this bit ends up coupling to the f mu nu terms of the gauge field in the n equals 2 vector. And this bit has no local physics because it couples to f mu nu dual, which is a total derivative, as we said last time. In terms of renormalization, n equals 4 is finite. The beta functions are 0, There's no renormalization. No infinite renormalization. Finite. So this means, you know, the couplings don't pick up a dependence on the renormalization scale. So they're conformally invariant. It doesn't matter what scale you... They're just constant with scale. So you have some conformal invariance with this theory. Okay, so the theory has an S-duality symmetry with this tau, where S-duality, where tau goes to some matrix A, B, C, D times itself, and A, B, C, D is in SL2Z. So that's the symmetry of the theory. So in other words, A, B, C, and D are integers, and the determinant of this matrix is 1 because it's a special transformation. Okay. And you've probably seen some of this when you're doing ADS CFT in previous lectures, I guess. Okay, good. So now we go think about a little about what happens when we make our transformation of the superfield local. So previously this was the transformation of the superfield. Well, these Qs are, you know, representations of operators on the superspace acting on it. And the epsilon and epsilon bar were constant in space and time before. So we wonder what happens when we make them space-time dependent, and actually they can depend on the theta coordinates as well. So what if epsilon, epsilon bar depend on x? Well, as you're probably aware, you get supergravity . So I remind you about for the Poincaré symmetry, there's this conserved current T mu nu, the stress energy tensor. And I have D mu, T mu nu is zero. So this comes with its gauge field, which you can write as G mu nu. And they're coupled in the Lagrangian, like G mu nu, T mu nu, as we said before. So there's a conserved charge, which is a generator of the Poincaré symmetry, conserved charge. And that's the integral over space of T and naught mu, or mu naught. Okay, so, and actually, if you work it out, this thing is P mu. So we could have done it all from the other way around. We could have started with this conserved charge and say, oh, that must correspond to some conserved current, and then we couple a gauge field to the conserved current. And of course, this thing, the G mu nu, plays the role of the graviton. Okay, so in supersymmetry, we have another conserved charge, as you know. So we have this Q alpha, it's a generator of the group, and it ought to correspond to a conserved charge. And in fact, it does. So we write it as d cubed x of the zeroth component of some conserved current with a spinner index. And there's a so this J mu alpha is a conserved supercurrent. And it's got an associated gauge field. Which must have a spinner index, so we'll call it psi, but it also must have a mu index, because we need to couple it to the conserved supercurrent. So I can write it like this. So this thing has both a vector index and a spinner index. It's called the Rarita-Schwinger field, after the people who invented it, Schwinger field. It's a spin 3/2 object. It's massless, so it has helicity 3/2. And it's the CZ partner of the graviton, so it's the gravitino. Yeah. No, well, yeah, space-time. So d mu, j mu, alpha is zero. So actually, the gravitino can be important in phenomenology. If it's, you have to do some Susie breaking and worry what happens to it. But it can be the lightest supersymmetric particle. And as we'll see when we do the MSSM, that particle plays a special role. It can be the dark matter in the universe. When you produce Susie particles in colliders, they decay down to the lightest guy. So you always end up with some of these lightest Susie particles in your detector, so you could be producing them. Now the LHC's operational again. All right, so lots of things happen actually when you make supersymmetry local, and there's quite a lot to it. And we're just sketching a couple of things here. So one thing that happens, which is very important, is that the scalar potential is modified. So for local Susie, we get this modification, and the F-term potential gets modified. So now it depends, we get this exponential factor out the front, depending on the Kähler potential. MP is M Planck, so 10 to 19 GV. Sometimes you'll see it without M Planck. People often use units where M Planck is 1. But it's instructive to keep it in for now. Then we have these covariant derivatives of the superpotential. And, all right, that's 3w squared over m blank squared. So, these covariant derivatives of the superpotential, it's like a supergravity covariant derivative. So it's defined as a d potential by d superfield I plus a piece, depends on the Kähler potential, times the superpotential. So there's a few things to notice about this. If we send the Planck scale off to infinity, we expect all the gravitational physics to decouple out of our theory. It's going to get infinitely heavy, propagators will be infinitely suppressed, and it won't have any effect on any prediction we make on our theory. And so we expect to go back to the global Suzy limit. So as MP tends to infinity, we expect to recover global Suzy, because the effect of the supergravity should be infinitely suppressed. And in fact, we can see that's what happens, because then, at least for this F-term potential, in that limit, the F-term potential goes to Kij. Oops, I should have put a hat there. Goes to that limit. So that's the global Suzy limit. Okay. So if you've got some Suzy breaking in this superpotential, so we'll talk more about the Suzy breaking in a second, then a useful fact to know is that the gravitino mass, so we usually write it as a capital G with a twiddle on it, the gravitino acquires a mass and it looks like E to the K over 2, K to the potential over 2 times mod W squared. So it's the vacuum expectation value of that, is the gravitino mass. Okay, so I mentioned Suzy breaking, so we've got to go on to discuss that in more detail, so it's the next big topic. Okay, so now I just need to remind you about some facts about breaking symmetries. So, has anyone done symmetry breaking with you? Yeah, they have. So you've done Goldstone's theorem. Yeah. All right, well, remember, okay, let's just talk about a scalar field. I'll just remind you, so it's on the top of your heads. So if we have a gauge transformation like this, group transformation on some fields phi I, which are in some representation of a Lie group, then infinitesimally, change in phi I for small parameters alpha looks like that. Oops. Okay. And the symmetry is broken. Spontaneous symmetry breaking occurs if the VEV of this change is non-zero. In other words, if TA times the vacuum expectation value of phi J is not zero. This is Goldstone's theorem. And in fact, you get a Goldstone boson. So each of these generators out, you know, you can cycle through A. Each of these generators, which has a non-zero value when acting on the vacuum state, sorry, this is the vacuum expectation value. For each one of those, the symmetry is broken. For the ones that are left that give you a zero when acting on the vacuum expectation value, those ones are left as symmetry generators. So you can get subgroups of the original group made out of all the generators which annihilate this vacuum expectation value. So for example, in the classic example is U1. Can be a gauge theory or not, as far as this is concerned. So let's say it isn't, it's just a global U1 to start with. So, so we really have the generator, this TA in this case, is just one dimensional, and it's some Q. So d delta phi is I alpha Q phi. So, if in terms of the original parameterization, rho isn't changing, but this field theta is. Okay, so if this gets a vacuum expectation value, then we get Goldstone boson. So Goldstone theorem tells you for each one of these broken generators, you get a massless boson associated with it. Each broken, so broken means non-zero value on the right, generator corresponds to a massless Goldstone boson. Sorry, yeah, I've written it wrongly. So rho is real and theta is also real. Yeah, so it's, phi is a complex field, and I've just written it in terms of two real components. Yeah. D phi, Laura. Yeah, I guess that's right. I think that, yeah, that's right. There should be, there should be a delta there. I think that's right. Right? Sorry, that's tautology. You're saying there should be a delta theta on the right. Delta theta is just I alpha Q. No, it's just I alpha Q times phi, right? I think this is right. Because what happens under the... All right, let's forget that for the time being. So this is just a parameterization of the field. So really, under a U1 transformation, phi goes to e to the I alpha q times phi, right? And so we just change the phase of this thing by the gauge transformation. Yeah. So under this gauge transformation, we get a change of phase by that. Okay, good. Yeah, thanks. So, under a similar token, right? So, Susie gets broken if Q alpha acting on the vacuum state is not zero. So if we break this generator, then we're going to break supersymmetry. So we can prove something using the anticommutation relation that we have. So we go back to n equals 1 CZ now. And we consider sigma bar nu times the anticommutator for a second. This thing, just substitute in for the anticommutator, beta dot alpha sigma mu alpha beta dot p mu. Okay, and then you know that this trace over sigma bar nu sigma mu gives us 2 eta mu nu. So this is 4 eta mu nu p mu, which is just 4 p nu, index upstairs. So we take the nu equals 0 component of this. This thing just looks like the identity matrix in this beta dot and alpha. So I can rewrite it in terms of, just a sum of these terms. So we've got a relation between the energy and these Qs and Q daggers. And the thing on the left-hand side is a sum of terms like some operator times operator dagger. Therefore, it's greater than or equal to 0 when sandwiched between vacuum states. Okay, so this is. So we've proved that shows that the energy of the vacuum, the energy of all the states actually is bigger than or equal to 0 in supersymmetry. And for Susie, the energy of the vacuum state is 0. Since, we can sandwich this thing between vacuum states, and for unbroken Susie, Q alpha annihilates the vacuum. But for broken Susie, so I'm talking about global broken Susie for now, the vacuum energy is bigger than naught because this thing has a non-zero value. So let's just look at some pictures of scalar potentials, and we can just see when the gauge symmetry is broken, what the potential looks like. And when Susie's broken, when both are broken, when neither are broken. So what I'm going to do is plot, some potential in terms of, say, let's do a U1 gauge theory, and we have imaginary part of phi and real part of phi. But these could be some other components of different scalar fields that could break a different symmetry group. It doesn't really matter. So the canonical picture that we have is some convex scalar potential. And of course, the vacuum state is given by the minimum of this scalar potential, which here lies on that direction, and a U1 gauge transformation, we can consider it as a passive transformation, which albeit depends on space and time, but we can consider it as rotating these two axes around. And, you know, if I've drawn this as being symmetric under that rotation, then we have U1 gauge symmetry of the vacuum, as you can't tell when you've rotated the thing around. And this has the vacuum energy is at the origin. So the energy of vacuum is zero. So Suzy is unbroken. And we have gauge symmetry unbroken. So that's case A. Case B is when you have something like the Higgs mechanism or the spontaneous symmetry breaking kicking in. And this is when we have the Mexican hat potential or the wine bottle . So the vacuum lies at some point along this ring, say there. All points around the ring are equivalent because there's a U1 gauge transformation. But now we can tell when we rotate the axes, the vacuum state moves through these albeit equivalent states. And so the gauge symmetry is broken. But at least the energy of the vacuum is zero, so Suzy is preserved. Yeah. Sorry, well, okay. It could be global. Yeah, this, I should really say the internal symmetry, or the U1 in this case, but the internal symmetry is broken. So it could be global or gauged. So we have another possible situation we can imagine with the same axes, where we just have a positive contribution to the potential from a cosmological constant, say. Okay, here we still have this cylindrical symmetry, and so the internal symmetry is okay, it's still intact, but the vacuum energy is non-zero. Evac not zero, therefore Suzy's broken. And the other case you can have, of course, is when we have a Mexican hat which doesn't lie on zero energy line. And this one has broken internal symmetry and broken Suzy. Yep.
Quick question. Scenario C.
Yeah.
Is that the vacuum energy, does that have any significance in non-supersymmetric theory?
In non-supersymmetric theory, yeah, sure. It gives you a cosmological constant. That is a cosmological constant. It's an energy density throughout all of space, right? And actually, so even in scalar field theory, you can get topological... Let me leave that. That's going a bit far. Yeah, let me just leave it, because it's a cosmological constant. All right, so there's two types of breaking for Suzy that we can have, that people talk about. There's F-term breaking and D-term breaking. And I'm just going to tell you about F-term breaking today. D-term breaking is quite similar, and it's in one of the problems that you might get this week, depending on how time goes. We'll see. So we consider, remember our transformations of chiral superfield. So we have a change in the scalar component of root 2 epsilon times the fermion, change in the fermion component, root 2 epsilon times the auxiliary field, plus I root 2 sigma mu epsilon bar d mu phi. And change in the auxiliary field is I root 2 epsilon bar sigma bar mu d mu psi. So remember that if any one of these changes gets a vacuum expectation value, then by Goldstone's theorem, we're going to break the symmetry and we'll get some additional massless field associated with that broken generator. So any of delta phi, delta psi, or delta F would break CZ. Non-zero would break CZ. But we know Lorentz symmetry is a good symmetry. It's tested to extreme accuracy in flat space, in the flat space limit. It's tested and it's good apart from when you have large general relativistic corrections, which we're ignoring for now. We're in danger here of breaking Lorentz symmetry because this psi doesn't just only transform under supersymmetry, it also transforms under the Lorentz group, right? So if we give delta psi a vacuum expectation value, that's also going to, by Goldstone's theorem, because this transforms non-trivially under the Lorentz group, that will also break the Lorentz symmetry. Yeah.
Do you mean that you're giving psi a non-zero?
No, delta psi.
But delta psi is something that is defined only when you give a transformation. So
when you give it? Yeah, so you're going to give one of these things a vacuum expectation value on the right? I mean, one of these fields, okay.
So this delta psi is the delta psi that you obtain with SUSY.
Yeah, that's right.
And not with the Lorentz symmetry, so it has nothing to do with delta
psi. Okay, let me see. So, sorry, you're right, I mean psi here. That's right. I don't mean delta psi, I mean psi. And we'd better not have d mu phi having a non-zero there because this transforms like a vector under Lorentz symmetry, so that would also break it. So the only thing that we're allowed to have on the right-hand side is a verb for F. F is a scalar field, so it doesn't transform non-trivially under a Lorentz transformation. So we can preserve Lorentz symmetry while giving it a non-zero expectation value. So that means that F is non-zero, and we get, just by looking at these transformations, that means we get a non-zero value for our delta psi, and that breaks CZ. Sorry, I got confused for a moment. So, just an analogy with Goldstone's theorem, you can generalize that to the case where you have gradedly algebras, and you can give the change in a fermion vacuum expectation value. And in this case, we get a Goldstone fermion instead of a Goldstone boson. massless Goldstone fermion. It's called the Goldstino, corresponding to CZ breaking. So let's just, for one superfield, if you only got one superfield, the F-term potential, remember, is dW by d phi squared, which is mod F squared. So for global CZ breaking, and it's not true in local CZ breaking, as we see, F getting a non-zero VEV means that we can see that the vacuum expectation value of the potential is bigger than zero. Okay, so that agrees with these pictures we've interpreted on the left-hand side. So now I want to give you an example of a model where we get this spontaneous CZ breaking, and it's famous, called the Arafati model. Arafati model. So it's an example of F-term breaking. So it's an n equals 1 global CZ model, and we have three chiral superfields labeled phi 1, 2, or 3. These are chiral superfields. We use the canonical Kähler potential for them. And we ad hoc just write down a superpotential like that. Okay. So we haven't said why it's got that form, but we just write it down as an example. At least we know from the non-renormalization theorem that we're not going to generate different terms in the superpotential. Okay, so from radiative corrections. So it's consistent to just write one down like that. And we take the limit where M, big M is large compared to little m. And we want to calculate the scalar potential now. And to do that, remember, we need to calculate this dW by d phi 1, d phi 2, d phi 3. Each of one of those is F1, F2, F3. So calculate those. It's just an exercise in differentiation. And that's what we get, and you know, we just mod square each of those F terms in order to get and add them in order to get the scalar potential. But what you can notice is It's impossible. To have all fi vacuum expectation values equals to zero. So imagine we'd set, if we set this one to zero, if F2 is zero, okay, then that means the vacuum expectation value of phi 3 is zero. But in that case, we have a non-zero value for this F1. Okay, so you can already see from these two lines that you can't set all of the fi to zero by choosing vacuum expectation values for phi 3, phi 2, and phi 1. Okay. So that means, hence one of them is non-zero at least, so we have Suzy breaking. F term, Suzy breaking in this case. So let's calculate scalar potential. Well, it's just Fi, Fi star, which is G squared phi 3 squared minus little m squared plus m squared phi 3 squared plus 2G phi 1 phi 3 plus big M phi 2 all squared. So, provided you can analyze this scalar potential and minimize it, and provided you have this condition between the couplings and the masses, then there's a minimum. The minimum of V is at phi 2 equals phi 3, which is 0. And phi 1 is arbitrary. Vacuum expectation value phi 1 is arbitrary. And it's because it's arbitrary, it's called a flat direction in the potential. You'll hear that a lot. You'll also hear it being called a modulus. So actually what the potential looks like in this case, if we plot it in terms of phi 1 and either phi 2 or phi 3, then, well, it's going to be difficult to draw, okay? But we have a flat direction along the phi 1 direction and a parabola in the other one. So, you know, the vacuum value of the universe lies somewhere along this line. So it can be phi 1 is anything and the other two fields are zero. So we'll take, for now, we'll take vacuum expectation value of phi 1 is 0 for convenience. It just makes the algebra a bit simpler. So we put, we decompose this complex field, scalar field phi 3, in terms of real subfields A plus IB over root 2. A and B are real fields. And we extract the quadratic terms of the potential, which are going to be useful because they tell us what the mass spectrum of the particles are. So now I want to work out the mass spectrum. It doesn't matter about the interaction terms. I'm just interested in the quadratic terms. And we get m squared minus 2g squared m squared over 2. So now I write it in terms of these a's and b's. So those are the quadratic terms, and we can see that, okay, so the thing proportional to b squared for a real field is mb squared over 2, and the thing proportional to a squared for real field is ma squared over 2. So what we see is that the real and imaginary parts of the original complex field acquire different masses and split. So the A's and B's now have different masses. So let's consider the fermions, because after all, it'll be a mass splitting between the fermions and the scalars, which signal is a consequence of our Susy breaking. And of course, this is the whole reason for introducing Susy breaking. We want to make the unseen superpartners of the standard model fields heavier, so they haven't been produced yet in colliders. So remember, the Lagrangian contains our mass term, Majorana mass term for the fermions, which looks like d2w by d phi I, d phi j times psi I, psi j. Okay, well, we can do this differential here, and what we get is a mass matrix which has mostly zeros in it, but there's just one mass term between phi 2 and phi 3. From the so this comes from the superpotential term plus 2 plus m phi 2 phi 3. Okay, so when we take d2w by d phi 2 d phi 3, we get an m. So what we see here is that one of the fermions is massless. This psi 1 is massless. Actually, this is the Goldstino in this case. And psi 2 and psi 3 acquire masses that are m. Okay, you have to change basis a bit. Take two orthogonal eigenstates, but you end up with two fermions of mass m. And so the final spectrum for the model is we have our psi 3 and psi 2 fermions with mass m, and then actually if we look back, both real and imaginary components of this phi 2 also have a mass m, but the fermion, the scalars corresponding to the superpartners of this psi 3 get split. One of them, the A field, becomes heavier, and its mass squared is, so its mass is root m squared plus 2g squared, little m squared. And then there's a B, which is root m squared minus 2g squared over m squared. Thanks. And then we have our massless fields, M is 0, with phi 1 and psi 1, and psi 1 is the Goldsteiner in this case. It's the massless fermion. So we now have one of the superfields breaking up. It's no longer mass degenerate. So this is a signal that we've broken Susie in our model, yeah.
Are we not having a massless phi 1 because we said expression of phi 1 equals 0?
Yeah, and you can just see in this quadratic potential, I mean, what I actually wrote was a 0 times mod phi 1 squared. So there is no quadratic piece for the phi 1. But yeah, it's a... sorry, if you mean if I'd taken non-zero for phi 1? Now the quadratic piece is still absent, because remember this is the second derivative. The mass squared is the second derivative of this potential, and this potential has zero second derivative in this phi one direction. So it's just massless. Even though the vacuum expectation value may be non-zero, it will still be massless. Yeah.
Can you draw a general conclusion that this is not the way supersymmetry is broken?
Yes. So you'll notice that one of the scalars is lighter than this fermion. So if we imagine, you know, generalizing this model and trying to make this fermion a quark, then what this says is we get one scalar heavier than the quark, which is what we want. That's good. We want to push it up to the TV scale. But one scalar is lighter as well. And that's no good. We can't. We need all the scalars to be heavier. The quarks. So we can see that this isn't going to work for us phenomenologically. But, in general, actually, we can prove that this kind of setup, where you break supersymmetry directly. Like this, isn't going to work either. You have to do something a bit more, we'll see, a bit more baroque, unfortunately. Okay, so the mass squared splitting between the scalar and the fermion is of order the F term. So the mass squared splitting between psi 3 and phi 3 is 2g squared little m squared, which is 2g times the F term. And in general, for F term breaking, the order of the Susie breaking scale, that means the mass splittings that you get, is square root of the F term, of the vacuum expectation value of the F term. That's a general feature, actually. Okay, I think we've had enough for today. I need a coffee. So next time, I'll just talk about briefly about how this stuff gets changed in when supersymmetry is local. There's a few important aspects that change. And then we're going to go on to do the MSSM, particle content and superpotential. Talk about some phenomenological consequences.